linger on in my mind. I referred to one yesterday, and they're these. Twice I've visited the concentration camp of Auschwitz and stood there in a kind of numbed silence at the enormity of what took place there. The terrible depths to which human beings could sink. The utter cruelty. Stand there by the gas chamber, which has been blown up, but much of it remaining, is really quite a frightful experience. They say that the birds no longer sing at Auschwitz. But in total contrast to that was that meeting arranged by the Holy Father at Assisi, where he gathered together all the leaders of the Christian churches, by and large, and all those of other religions. And the sight of the Holy Father sitting there with all the Christians on one side, the Dalai Lama and all the others on the other side, had that wonderful vision of what the world could be like. There we were to try to celebrate peace. I couldn't help but reflect that the only person in the world who could have brought such disparate people together was the Pope. And that too was something quite powerful. It was that way that one saw perhaps how the civilization of love, about which Paul VI spoke, could in the end be effected and realized. And I've always thought that the Holy Father's travels around the world, expensive though they were, very tiring they always have been, but nonetheless, I think the fruits of all those travels will be culled, if you cull fruits, in the next millennium. So with that kind of background, I composed this particular talk entitled Changing Hearts and Changing Minds. Because if the civilization of love is to be realized, it is through changing hearts and changing minds. And the process is going to be long and tedious, but it's a process in which we must all be involved, a task which we all have to undertake, changing the minds and the hearts of the people. So it was those thoughts were the background of this particular talk. We're living in a time of profound change and uncertainty. Economic development and technological advances are transforming society at an ever faster rate. The gap between the rich and the poor grows apace. This applies both to the gulf between rich and poor within countries and also to the gap between rich and poor countries. Poverty still has many faces. One in five of the world's population lack the means to live with dignity and self-respect. Scientific progress continues to bring extraordinary benefits into almost every aspect of life. Yet at the same time, environmental degradation spreads largely unchecked. and fears grow about the implications of advances in genetic research. Whilst in material terms many people are increasingly well off, the same cannot necessarily be said for the quality of human relationships. The quality of life is threatened by the instability of family life, by rising crime and especially drug trafficking. Then there are threats to life itself, the almost routine destruction of human life through abortion, and now the spectre of euthanasia. So as we approach the threshold of the third millennium, there are both signs of hope, but also reasons for fear. In 1991, just before the extraordinary collapse of communism, just after the extraordinary collapse of communism in what was then the Soviet Union, I made a pilgrimage to the shrine of Our Lady at Częstochowa in Poland. I traveled with young people from my own diocese and elsewhere in response to the invitation from the Holy Father. About 1.5 million young people came together to celebrate, worship, learn, and pray. Over 40,000 came from Russia. It was a remarkable experience of community. And there were among the young an immediate acceptance of each other, a willingness to communicate and to share. And it was clear from the discussions we had and the responses of so many that the fundamental values of the kingdom do speak powerfully to this generation, and especially to those from countries where for decades those values were systematically denied and actively suppressed. Appeals to the personal value of life and love, to the fundamental principles of truth, freedom, and justice, found an echo in the hearts and the minds of the young. I had the same experience when attending the World Youth Gathering 4 years later in Denver. And it will no doubtless be the week after next, the same experience in Paris. There is, I believe, a yearning in many people for their moral and spiritual renewal, to restore respect for truth and to rebuild trust. In societies like ours, where freedom of choice has been too often elevated into an idol, the rediscovery of shared moral and spiritual values is essential if democratic freedoms and even the fabric of law and order are to be preserved. The task is a formidable one, for it involves nothing less than a transformation of our culture. By culture, I mean that sum total of those values which determine our ways of thinking and acting. Many of the values prevalent in today's society are too self-regarding and too materialistic. If such attitudes are to be transformed, then minds and hearts must undergo profound changes. This task, in which the church has a very important role to play, involves first of all appealing to our common humanity. It means proclaiming the sanctity of human life, proclaiming the unique value of every individual, the need of all humans for each other. It means proclaiming the inviolable rights of every person and their responsibilities, and protecting those who become vulnerable through illness or disability or old age. It means escaping from a mentality which sees society just as a mass of individuals placed side by side without any concern or responsibility for one another. It means embracing instead a vision of the common good, a culture which gives priority to bringing about those social conditions which would best serve to promote and protect the dignity of all. That is the aim, and the key to it is, as I have said, changing minds and hearts. And what are the most powerful instruments for changing minds and hearts in our society? I suggest that there are three: education, family life, and the media. I therefore propose now to offer you some reflections on these. You'll appreciate that I'm speaking very much from my own English background, and you will make whatever adjustments seem to apply to your own society and culture. Let me speak first about education. There is no greater contribution than the church can make to the welfare of young people than to provide good Catholic schools. Teachers today don't have an easy task, certainly not in my country. For many people, religion has no place other than as something of merely marginal interest. Many of the families from which pupils come to our schools are lapsed. Either they do not practice their faith, or it's very low among their priorities. So what can teachers do in these circumstances? Remember that response to God should not be assessed only in terms of what we usually connect with Catholic practice. There is, as I've already said, in every person, a space which only God can fill. I believe that each one of us is an anima naturalita religiosa, a naturally religious soul. When religious values are presented attractively, they will often find an echo within those to whom they are addressed. Teachers should never cease to strive to win for God the minds and the hearts of the young under their care, nor to lose sight of the vision of what a Catholic school should be, a strong community in which teachers and pupils share a common philosophy of life, where the truths of our faith and the principles of Catholic morality are taught in a professional and competent manner. Today, education is often considered to be primarily a matter of equipping young people to earn a living in a demanding world which is highly complex and constantly changing. People do not often concern themselves overmuch with the assumptions which lie behind such an attitude. In fact, there is a great need to devote time and energy to thinking about values in education and their ultimate purpose. This raises the question, what is education for? And we cannot answer this without first understanding and an agreement about the very nature of a person and the individual worth of each individual person. As Catholics, rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we affirm that we are made in the image and likeness of God and created ultimately so that we might share the life and share the love of God for all eternity. Writing in 1933, as the Nazi threat was beginning to take shape in Germany, Christopher Dawson, historian, philosopher of those days in our country, Christopher Dawson wrote these words, which I believe with true prophetic insight. In fact, the great tragedy of modern civilization is to be found in the failure of material progress to satisfy human needs. The modern world has more power than any previous age, but it has used its new power for destruction as much as for life. It has more wealth, yet we are on the throes of vast economic crisis, 1933. It has more knowledge, and yet our knowledge seems powerless to help us. What our civilization lacks is not power and wealth and knowledge, but spiritual vitality. And unless it is possible to secure that, nothing can save us from the fate that overtook the civilization of classical antiquity on so many other civilizations that were powerful and brilliant in their day. Christopher Dawson spoke even then of the need to recover spiritual vitality. It was 60 years ago, 70 years ago. Nearly 70 years later, that need is even more urgent. Education and schools can play a part in regenerating society. But to achieve that aim, we must have regard to three interrelated objectives. Our schools should promote in their pupils a personal spiritual life, a recognition and acceptance of objective norms, moral norms, and a vivid sense of social responsibility. What I say here of schools, of course, applies mutatis mutandis to families. A personal spiritual life, a recognition and acceptance of objective moral laws, and a vivid sense of social responsibility. Those three. The first objective is the need to inculcate and foster a personal spiritual life. And by personal spiritual life, I mean the process whereby God touches both mind and heart and awakens in us an awareness of Him and a desire for union with Him. It is quite possible for someone to be brought up in the Christian faith, to be educated at church schools, to attend church regularly, and yet never to feel close to God or to have a deeply religious experience. This is a tragic deprivation. For the spiritual life is not another worldly, rarely attainable luxury, but it is an essential element in any fully human existence. There has to be the expectation of finding God in all things. Our five senses are windows through which the glory of God enters into our inmost being. He is encountered in our very exploration into the worlds of science, nature, history, the arts, and literature. This experience and knowledge has to be interpreted and integrated by deep study of the Word of God, which should form the heart of an imaginative and a creative program of religious education. At the heart of every religious program must be prayer. Teaching the young how to pray, and not simply requiring them to pray at set times and on certain occasions, is both profoundly educational and spiritually invigorating. It is also the most direct and positive way to help young people to discover their inner selves and begin a lifelong process of growth. The second objective is to teach our pupils the importance of fundamental moral norms. Today, secular world promotes the view that conscience has merely to do with acting as one sees fit. Individuals are thought to be free to pick and choose the precepts and commandments they observe, as if morality were entirely a matter of choice and opinion, and there was no such thing as objective right or objective wrong. In these circumstances, and despite its being deeply unfashionable to do so, it is more important than ever to underline the objectivity of moral norms and the need to be guided by them. Moreover, we must reverse the contemporary fashion of confining moral values to the sphere of personal relationships, leaving public life and international relations to market forces and to self-interest. This is a false dichotomy. Unless society and states recognize the validity of objective moral norms and the legitimacy of legislation based on these norms, the door remains open to anarchy and the supremacy of the strong. It is, of course, one thing to uphold moral laws and to reach a coherent private and public morality, quite another to command this to young people and help them to make these values their own. We have to start by demonstrating at all times the necessary link between a moral life and a life that is worth living, is both fulfilling and genuinely human. The first disciples began to follow Jesus because they were attracted to him. Goodness is attractive and, in fact, deeply compelling. We must encourage that crucial inner movement from doing the right thing because I ought to doing the right thing because I want to and understand why. Moral education is made more credible and effective as promoted by educators and parents who are seen to be living that morality in their daily lives. The maxim, don't do what I do, do what I say, was always suspect, but today it's a recipe for disaster and failure. Today people of all ages demand a match between theory and practice, between principles and daily behavior. And the young are quick to spot when that is not so. As Pope Paul VI said, speaking to laity in 1974, modern man, woman, listens more readily to witnesses than to teachers. And if he listens to teachers, it's because they're witnesses. The ideal, of course, is that school itself should be a community where truth, justice, love, and community are lived out in structures, relationships, and activity. These considerations lead naturally to the third objective, which is to encourage a sense of social responsibility and a study of the Church's social teaching. In the past, Catholics have been accused, perhaps with some justice, of stressing personal sinfulness and guilt and of overemphasizing the need for individual redemption. Today, we need to proclaim more vigorously that the individual, in fact, is made for communities and communion and community, and that we are called to save the world and witness to the kingdom. Our commitment to the kingdom and its values and our concern for society is not a passing irrelevance. It is profoundly theological and has been carefully developed, as you well know, in successive social encyclicals, of which the latest, Pope John Paul's Centesimus Annus, is one which I commend to all of you. Religion and religious education are not soft, self-centered, optional pursuits. They are part of the spiritual, intellectual, and cultural heritage of the human race and should be made accessible to all. In our schools, we should be committed to the pursuit of excellence at every level, academic, technical, physical, and in integrating of them all into a coherent vision which benefits each individual in his or her total humanity. By so doing, we are helping to stimulate that spiritual vitality about which Christopher Dawson wrote. The passage I quoted earlier on goes this way. Now, this question of spiritual vitality, whether in the case of the individual or society, is the very center and essence of the religious problem. Religion is not philosophy, or science, or ethics. It is nothing more or less than communion with the divine life, whether it be regarded from within as the act of communion itself, or externally as a system of beliefs and practices by which man brings his life into relation with the powers that rule the life of the universe. I spoke in some length about education, but I want now to go on to say a word about family life. They are, in fact, linked. What one says of the one, one can say of the other, and how important that what is said in the school should be echoed in the family, what is said in the family should be echoed in the school, and it's not always so. Parents, as you know well, are the first and primary educators of their children, and it is the quality of family life which, for good or ill, most profoundly forms each of us, shapes the way we relate to each other and act in the world. The failure of the Church and of society is rooted in family life. In your country, as in mine, family life is under threat. The litany of symptoms is familiar, including loss of security, widespread divorce, a rise in depression and suicide, especially among young people, the long-term consequences of increasing family breakdown are also becoming more widely recognized, especially the deep and lasting effect on children in terms of education attainment, health, happiness, and the ability to sustain committed relationships in later life. And I say here, and say with all conviction, of course we all know of many, many families where there has been breakdown, where the parent who remains, the mother usually, has done a fantastic job in bringing up the children, and in some cases a better job of parents who stayed together. We must always recognize that. But families depend on trust and mutual responsibility. The expectations family members have of one another, not usually articulated, are in fact framed by certain fundamental moral values: fidelity, loyalty, obedience, compassion, justice. It's through the everyday interactions of family life, including failure, forgiveness, reconciliation, that the moral life is taught and sustained. It is in the family that the child learns to love by first being loved unconditionally. In the family, we first learn that other people matter, that we have responsibilities to them, that we cannot think only of ourselves. At the heart of any vision of the family are the values of life and love, and these two belong together and cannot be separated. Of course, not all people find that they are called to be married. Single people, celibates, have other and equally authentic ways of showing the love of Christ. But for most people, marriage is the way Christ calls them to love deeply. It's a vocation which calls for a radical and freely given commitment from each to the other. It demands fidelity and self-sacrifice. It is meant to be lifelong and exclusive. These are not externally imposed requirements. They are the innate characteristics, surely, of married love. The Church's teaching presents humanity with very high ideals about love, the sacredness of sex, the exclusiveness and permanence of every marriage, and responsible parenthood. But in fact, the Church is only pointing to what it is to be human, and therefore what it is that human beings need for their deepest well-being and fulfillment. The gap between the Church's understanding of marriage and some values and attitudes prevalent in our culture today is all too obvious. The idea of marriage as a permanent lifelong commitment, or of confining sexual relationships within marriage, are seen by many today as unattainable fantasies far removed from reality, quaint traditions from the past. In fact, I would argue the exact opposite. It strikes me that in our society's elevation of freedom of choice to the apparent exclusion of other values, and in his seemingly endless obsession with sex manifested in so much of the media today, what we are witnessing is the peddling of unreal fantasies about what it is to be human, false promises of what make for happiness, exact opposite to what has been peddled so often by our media. The Church's teaching, in contrast, confronts us head on with the realities of responsible choice and the obligations which flow from making binding commitments to others. First, we have extended choice into the marriage relationship, beyond the choice of whom to marry, into choosing whether to stay married. I was struck by the following comment made by a Professor Gerald Rochford from Aberdeen University in a recent lecture. I read it twice. He said that the marriage vow represents the moment at which we move through choice to a sense of destiny, to create a sense of security within which a myriad of choices and therefore mistakes can be made safely. For this vow to be retractable, denied, as it clearly now is, places upon the spouse the burden of needing to be perfect. Without the security within which to be imperfect, without being abandoned. The marriage vows represent the attempt to save ourselves from limitless and therefore insatiable choice. The irony is that limitless choice induces a sense of compulsion, the sense of being driven rather than free. People who are married and secure in their marriage, they're free to be imperfect. But if you know that there's an escape, you're no longer free to be imperfect. It's difficult to convey the church's teaching when prevailing attitudes are that young people have no need to be chaste, only to be careful. How in such a climate can we begin to persuade young people not to live together before marriage, or not to indulge in casual sex? How do we re-educate consciences to realize that sex outside marriage is wrong? How can we rescue the word love from being, as it is in the minds of so many of our contemporaries, synonymous with the word sex? How can young people be brought to recognize the value of a permanent commitment publicly expressed in marriage? Profound, vital questions. But the first step must be the example they are set. If the child sees in its parents a marriage that is good, though may not be perfect, that example will fashion the young person's own attitude towards marriage. If, on the other hand, this is not the child's experience, then not only will it be disillusioned with marriage, but more profoundly, perhaps, the child loses its sense of trust in the adult world. The family is the first school of life and love. Each of us is marked indelibly by our own family and childhood experience. In saying this, we must recognize the dedication and mutual commitment in very many families today, including many who have suffered failure and loss, as I indicated earlier on. No society can afford to neglect the health of the family. Families are the basis of community life and the principal means by which all human societies propagate and carry their existence into the future. The nurturing of children is the most primitive, responsible, and profound human endeavor. And we're very far from giving due recognition and support to parents who stay at home to devote themselves to this. Family life is, in fact, astonishingly resilient. Despite the stresses imposed on many families by today's cultural and economic climate, very many survive intact and flourish. The family forms minds and hearts. That's why it's such a powerful force for the cultural change we need. And that is why all of you are in the vanguard of that process. I turn now to the third area which I identified besides education and family life as a key factor in changing our culture. This is the mass media. I can only speak from my experience in the United Kingdom, and even then as very much a non-expert. It was clear to me that the influence the media has over the young today is immense. And I would think it is only going to increase as the means of communication become cheaper and more sophisticated. The presence of television, radio, videos, films, newspapers, the internet and the rest provide an inescapable accompaniment to daily life. Television especially has the powerful effect in helping to shape, create and reinforce public taste and values as well as just reflecting them. What can be done? First of all, to recognize that the media culture is here to stay. Parents and teachers have to cultivate in young people the power of critical reflection. I'm often amazed, in fact, at the sophistication of many young people who have a keen awareness of when they are being manipulated by what they see. If young people are critically aware of the influences constantly flooding in on them, they can more easily discern the potential for good and learn to steer clear of the more destructive. Secondly, it's essential to engage with those responsible for broadcasting in the media. There are those who see broadcasting as just another consumer good, whose function is no more than to give individual viewers what they want, and not necessary to serve their needs as citizens, such as for information, for education, for shared experiences and common knowledge. In fact, broadcasting, precisely because it has such a powerful influence in shaping tastes and values, must have a social purpose supported by a framework of moral values. This immediately attracts the objection that in a pluralist society this cannot be and should not be done, because there is no agreement about whose values, moral values, should be promoted. But this is a weak answer. First of all, those responsible for the media are in the value business. They operate in moral space and are inevitably promoting some value or others. There's no value-free position, and they therefore have a moral responsibility for what they promote through what they do. Secondly, what this stance ignores is that there is a common good of society, a set of conditions which promote the well-being and thus the moral good of each citizen. There are fundamental moral values on which all society depends, such as respect for truth, for justice, the need for compassion, care of the environment, and above all, respect for the sacredness of human life. This is why broadcasting is more than a consumer good and should seek to provide programs which inform and educate people into the right kinds of beliefs, values, and dispositions. In the United Kingdom, there are any number of difficult questions to do with regulation, public service broadcasting, and here I recognize that the situation in this country is even more complex. All I would say is that this is an important debate in which we must engage. I'd also point the importance of people with sound religious and moral commitments becoming actively involved in the media professions and influencing them from the inside, as indeed many people already are trying to do. Perhaps this is the most likely way in which the media can become an agent for changing minds and hearts. Let me now return to where I began. The threshold of the third millennium is a fitting time for reflection and preparation, a moment to dwell on the challenges which face us as Christians living out the gospel. Besides the media, I single out education and family life, because these are two of the principal ways through which the gospel entrusted to us is communicated and passed on, ways in which minds and hearts can be changed. Gathered here this week, we've had the opportunity to reflect on our own lives, to listen to one another, above all, to seek the truth. The coming of the Holy Spirit in the church is a permanent gift which gives light to the church and makes its witness possible. Pentecost is now and always, and this is the ground of our faith in the future, in the possibility of renewal and transformation, and the inspiration for us to play our part here and now in building the kingdom of God. That's it, folks. Now, this has never been delivered to anybody before. You are the first. It's going to be delivered again tonight. Frankly, I think a lot of it is boring. But if you've got any suggestions to make, to shorten, improve, omit, then I'd be very happy to have them, because I don't see why I should torture two audiences in one day. But maybe will we be having a discussion on this?
We will be having a discussion. Those who are M's through W's will be back at 11.
Oh yes, good, because then it would be very helpful for me to have feedback.
And for the rest of people, if you have questions right now, you could send them up on a piece of paper. We've got like 5 minutes. We have some questions. The other thing is that, and some people did it, the idea, this is an experiment, but the idea is that as you think during the day, you write out thoughts and put them in, and we will also have questions tomorrow morning after. So there'll be two times, the discussion at 11, and then after you finish tomorrow morning, there will be time.
Too late for tonight, though.
Okay, the 11 o'clock will be all. Okay. We'll only have time for like two questions.
Tell us about your formation. What was your family of origin like? When did you feel you knew that you should be a priest? What and why did you become a priest? What is the hardest part of your job? Tell us about your formation. Inadequate. What was your family of origin like? My family of origin was my family. My mother was a Catholic and French. My father was a doctor, not a Catholic, and really fundamentally Scottish. So I'm a hybrid of many different bloods. That's why we are such a mess. Now then, when did you feel or knew the call to be a priest? I had to compete against my mother's prayers, who prayed that she should have a son, a priest, and she won. I'm here. When or why, why did you become a priest? Because I felt quite young that this is what God wanted from me. What is the hardest part of your job as a shepherd? Talking about myself. What is most fun? Not talking about myself. What is most rewarding? All of you. My hat. As a cardinal, can you live in community at your monastery? Answer, no, because I got to live in my diocese, which is a long way from my monastery, alas. Can you dress up your cardinal garments one day this week? No, because I haven't got them. I bought me a little red thing on the top of the head. I nearly wore it this morning, then I thought, no, I'm not going to show off, for heaven's sake. When did you know you wanted to enter religious life? Answered already. Do you have others in your family that are priests? No. Monks? No. Religious? No. No. I had an aunt who was an Anglican nun, and a great uncle who was a rector of a seminary. What does a cardinal do that a bishop cannot do? I don't know. Well, you elect a pope to start with, and you've got a bit more weight to chuck around.